Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you've heard it once, you've heard it a thousand times. Behind every great man, there is a great woman, or something to that effect. And that relationship, when it came to Clementine and Winston Churchill, ran the gamut from wartime strategizing to politics to the pantry. The HBO film The Gathering Storm captures a little bit of the latter issue.
Mrs. Churchill?
Mrs. Lanmere. Good morning, madam. Something the matter? What's wrong?
It's Mr. Monks, madam.
Butcher?
Yes, madam. It seems we haven't paid his bill for several weeks, and he says he'd rather not provide us with any more meat until the account's settled.
I'll write a check, and you can send one of the girls to deliver it. Thank you, Mrs. Lanmere. Thank you, madam.
Who is it?
Kingston. Have you paid Mr. Monks?
Where, what?
The butcher from Westrum. Have you paid his bills?
My dear Clemmy, I'm trying to save India from Mr. Gandhi and his gang of subversive Hindus, to save British imperial power from a disastrous eclipse and save the Tory party from an act of shame and dishonour.
In other words, you haven't paid the bill.
For God's sake, woman, I can't do everything.
He certainly could not. Journalist and author Sonia Purnell captures this and the many other facets of their relationship and 57-year marriage in her new book entitled Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. Sonia Purnell joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
The British version of the book is entitled First Lady, The Life and Wars of Clementine Churchill. I like that better. It says to me a lot more about the book. Why the difference? I know books are titled differently in different countries, but why?
Okay, well, I suppose First Lady obviously has a very specific meaning in America. You have the First Lady, part of the Constitution. We don't in Britain. There is the Prime Minister's wife, or in one case, the Prime Minister's husband, but they have no specific role. The job, isn't even really a job, the position, if you like, is open to each person to interpret or make what they will of it. No one has come anywhere close to what Clementine made of it. She was much more like an American First Lady, which is why we sort of recalled the book that in this country, to actually draw parallels between her and Eleanor Roosevelt. And in some ways, she was even more powerful than Eleanor Roosevelt. The reason why we say the life and wars of Clementine Churchill, obviously she was at the center of two world wars. She also had her inner wars. She struggled with depression. She struggled with self-doubt. She was an amazingly courageous person. Inside, she was quite a timid one, but you would never know that looking at her from the outside, which makes her all the more courageous because she was fighting these demons.
Yeah.
In America, we just wanted to make sure that everyone knew which Clementine we were talking about, and obviously Winston Churchill was of such enormous stature. We just wanted to draw attention to the fact that his wife, although incredibly important in every aspect of his life, has really been pretty much ignored and overlooked until now.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I think partly because he is such a giant, a legend. It's a bit like that, that expression where, you know, acorns never grow in the shadow of an oak tree. I think in a little way it's that she didn't seek recognition. She didn't seek attention. She wanted the legacy of her husband to be the main priority and to be what everyone was talking and thinking about. However, it's very interesting that many of the Americans who came over to Britain in the war and worked very closely with them, such as the American ambassador, Gil Wynant, Harry Hopkins, FDR's special envoy, and others, they saw just how really the Churchills were a partnership. You've got two Churchills for the price of one, and Winston utterly, totally depended on her.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the life and times of Clementine, that is Clementine as in Mrs. Winston Churchill. My guest is a journalist and author of a new book entitled Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill, Sonia Purnell. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right, she's been characterized as his secret weapon, and in your book you make it clear that he knew that better than anybody.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In fact, 3 years after the war, on the 40th anniversary of their wedding, so this is September 1948, they were on vacation in the south of France. They always had separate rooms, by the way, and this holiday was no, you know, difference from that. And he slipped a little note under her bedroom door, and in it he thanked her for all the happiness she'd given him in what he described as a world of accident and storm. But he also said that she had made his life and any work that he had done during his life possible. And I think, you know, that is absolutely right. She was his greatest influence, his most important advisor, his spin doctor. She vetted those speeches and she wrote little extracts of them. She edited them, she rehearsed them with him. She counseled him on his meetings with FDR, with Stalin, with De Gaulle. She was involved in everything. And I think he realised more and more just how important she was and how she helped him to become the great leader he became. And I think, really, the more I looked into it, the more I realised that quite likely he would never have become Prime Minister without her, and certainly he wouldn't have become the great Prime Minister he became without her.
She was not a conservative like her husband, although he was briefly in the liberal camp when they first married. How did she develop her political sensibilities, and how did she hold on to them, considering who she rubbed elbows with most of the time?
Well, she never forgot what it was like to be outside those sort of charmed circles of power and privilege. She was an aristocrat herself. She was the granddaughter of a Scottish earl. The family seat was this wonderful haunted castle in the Scottish Highlands. But her mother was a bit of a Victorian wild child. She got divorced. She really had no money. She had lots and lots of lovers, by the way, but very, very little money. They kept changing address. They moved from one set of furnished rooms to another, always on the move, and very often with very little money. Clementine absolutely was so humiliated as a child, having to ask for credit in stores for food. She never forgot what that was like. She grew up in and around the fish market in Dieppe in northern France. She saw, you know, people really struggling. But those memories never left her. She married Winston Churchill, who never poured his own bath, who never travelled on a bus, who had a valet to help him dress. But she wanted him to understand that not everyone lived a life like that. And she was always telling him what it was like to, you know, live without money, not to know where your next meal was coming from. She was his social conscience, if you like, the nearest thing he had to direct line to the people. And she was totally thrilled when she first met him and he was in the Liberal Party. And he actually helped set up the welfare state in Britain. Perhaps a lot of people don't know that, but it was pensions for the poor, unemployment exchange so people could go and get new jobs. And she absolutely loved that. He then went back to the Conservative Party. She was never as keen, although she would always support him. But she always kept reminding him, remember what it's like not to be you but and to be outside the circles in which we now move. And so she was this sort of this wonderful sort of voice in his ear. And those speeches in the Second World War very much drew on her experience of what it was like to be out there, to be sort of normal person, everyday life. And that was just one of the ways in which she influenced him for the better.
Right. She had a very dysfunctional upbringing. So did he.
Yes, I know. I mean, this is what's so interesting. And I think quite likely they found great comfort in each other. Both had had these mothers who were occupied elsewhere. Both had many, many lovers. Clementine's mother, sometimes 10 lovers on the go at once. Jenny Winston's mother supposedly had 200 in her lifetime, maybe including the odd king. They were otherwise occupied and didn't take great interest in their children. Mm-hmm. So both Clementine and Winston grew up quite emotionally deprived, very insecure. You might not believe that about Winston Churchill, but he was insecure. But Clementine gave him this security, this feeling of, as he put it, being safe. He said being with her made him feel safe. And I think, therefore, that safety, that security that she gave him enabled him to be that man in 1940, the only one who would stand up to Hitler. So they drew from each other. They drew strength and resolve and courage from each other. But they had to, because their childhoods had been really very tough in both cases.
She was not an outgoing child. When you first describe her as a youngster, she was not outgoing, and that bothered her mother, who wanted her to be more flamboyant. But she was bold and athletic as an adult. How did that come about?
Well, I think Clementine went on what we would now call, although she wouldn't have used these words, she went on a journey. Yes, she was, as a child, incredibly tearful, fearful, hardly spoke a word, didn't have any friends. Her mother just got furious with her, impatient with her. She had an older sister called Kitty, much more flamboyant, flirtatious, slightly impudent. And Lady Blanche and Clementine's mother much preferred her. Tragically, Kitty died at the age of 16, but still Lady Blanche and Clementine never drew close. And so there was this girl who was, she was so frightened of a moth once, she nearly broke her ankle running away from a moth. So she was so timid, but she realised, I think, that that was just not going to give her the sort of life she wanted. And her the man she thought was her father, but in fact wasn't, and she was almost certainly illegitimate, tried to kidnap her at one point, and she had the wherewithal and the courage to escape. And I think that's the first glimpse we get of this inner steel. So behind the tears, behind the fearfulness, was something really quite incredible. And again in her life, when there was a real crisis, when there was a world war, when her husband was in trouble, that inner steel showed itself. And people who met her during the Second World War would never guess that inside was a really quite tremulous person, but one who had to become this figure of composure and calm and courage. And that's what I found really amazing about her, that she refashioned herself. She changed herself from what she was naturally into the woman she wanted to be and into the wife she wanted to be for Winston Churchill.
Why did, I was surprised to read how often people referred to her as silly or dense or not very intelligent?
Well, I think that was really more during the early years of her marriage. And I think it was quite largely because she was shy initially. She didn't push herself forward. She didn't come from, you know, the conventional ruling classes. There was an element of snobbery there. But there was also, I think, you know, at that time, it was quite common for women to be called those things. And certainly she wrote to the Times of London on one occasion in outrage at the way that women were described. And someone was suggesting that if a woman had to make a decision, her brain would melt. They were suggesting this seriously in the Times of London. So Clementine was quite right, I think, to take issue with that. So there was a sort of a normalcy, if you like, in calling women those things. Mm-hmm. But I think some people were also threatened because right from the start, Clementine wanted to get involved in every aspect of politics. And women hadn't really done that. And I think part of those comments were simply that they resented her and were rather shocked at how much she wanted to get involved in Winston's career.
My guest is Sonia Purnell. She's author of a new book. It's entitled Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the life and times of Clementine Churchill, the wife of British Prime Minister Sir Winston Churchill. During their 57-year marriage, they weathered many storms, perhaps the greatest of which was the Second World War, not the least of which were their children. In this scene from the HBO film The Gathering Storm, this Clementine and Winston are enjoying a rare, quiet evening playing cards. The muffled music in the background signifies that their daughter, Sarah, is again practicing tap dance on the floor above them.
I think she wants to do it professionally.
Annoying people?
No, the stage.
Nonsense. Girls on the stage to marry into a good family. Sarah already belongs to a good family. Ladies do not become chorus girls.
Hmm. Clearly, they did not see eye to eye on that issue and many others associated with their children. Still with us is journalist and author of a new biography of Clementine Churchill entitled Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. Sonia, thanks again for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
I refer to their children as a particular storm, but Sarah was not necessarily their most troubled child. Randolph was the big thorn in their sides. What does Clementine's story tell us about why that might have been?
Well, you know, I was talking about how Clementine and Winston both had troubled childhoods, both emotionally deprived childhoods. I don't think they really had a role model for being a good parent. I think both of them failed in various ways at being a parent. They were busy saving the world. They were busy fighting wars. They were busy making him become prime minister. They weren't around a great deal. They made the terrible mistake until their final child of not hiring a loving, constant, you know, long-term nanny. There was really no one apart from a series of inexperienced, not terribly good young girls who just left after a few weeks. They couldn't really cope. And so these children were not really given a stable home that they needed, particularly the first four. And three of them went on to have terrible drink problems. One of the children died in infancy at the age of 2.5. You could argue that child, Marigold, a tragic death, may have survived if she'd been with her parents. She was with a very, very inexperienced young nursery maid. There was only Mary, who was looked after by an impoverished cousin, who they did finally hire as the nanny they should have done right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary grew up in a sort of stable environment and did very well, had a rich and fulfilled life, and died only last year. But three other adult children all took to drink, and one of them, Diana, took her own life. And it really was the family who paid the price for Churchill's greatness in a sense.
Randolph was, like I said, a huge thorn in their sides, mm-hmm. and particularly did not get along with his mother.
No, that's right. When I said that Winston had his own faults as a parent, as a father, he didn't set boundaries. He indulged Randolph. And, you know, if Clementine tried to discipline him, he was a very naughty child, he would run to Winston, who would give him an instant reprieve. But of course, that meant that he disliked his mother. He thought it was only his mother who was trying to be harsh with him. And the more he grew up, the bigger he got, the more difficult she found him. And at one point, you know, when he was an adult, she used to tell her staff never to leave her on her own in the same room as Randolph. I mean, the relationship deteriorated to that point. He was drunk often. He was often abusive, often obnoxious. It was very, very difficult. The extraordinary thing was that once Winston died in 1965, there was a rapprochement between Randolph and Clementine. And it's true that when they had spent time together on their own, they had enjoyed each other's company. And, you know, later on in her life, after her husband's death, she did enjoy being with Randolph sometimes. And he went to great lengths to please her, to pick her flowers from his garden, to choose books that he knew that she would enjoy. I think the tensions of being Winston Churchill's children were very great, and I think it was very, very difficult for all of them.
I read a very short online bio of Clementine, which, you know, I know you're not supposed to do, but I did it anyways. and I quote this in this, and I wonder how this happened. It wrote that she had balanced a keen political intellect with a love of children and family life and a talent for offering her husband the support he needed. But there was lots of evidence that she wasn't a warm and fuzzy mother or grandmother. And I'm wondering how, was this just a typical characterization of someone in her position?
Yes, I mean, to some extent, I think we have to remember that it was quite normal for upper-class British families at the time not to see much of their children. Mm-hmm. Quite often it would just be once a day. I'm sure you've seen in Downton Abbey where the children are brought down at tea time and the adults see them for 10 minutes and the children are perfectly clean and ready for bed and very polite, and it's all quite stiff and formal. That was quite typical. I think the Churchills probably took it to, you know, one extreme. I think she did love her children. I think she found it difficult to show that. She certainly wasn't one of those mothers who could just, you know, lie on the nursery floor and build train tracks and sandcastles on the beach and that kind of thing. It didn't come naturally to her. Later in life, as I say, she found it easier. And as a grandmother, actually, I would say that she was. She found that easier. And she said to her daughter, Mary, oh, now I see what fun you have with your young children. She was obviously rather wistful that she hadn't done those nursery teas with hers. And perhaps she could do a little bit more as a grandmother. And so she was a lovely grandmother. She made the most wonderful Christmases. You know, she was great at decorating the tree.
Yeah.
And the house and making it all really fun. And that was something she was excellent at. And that was her way of trying to make up for her other failings, I think.
I thought it was so interesting. You mentioned earlier that she didn't ask for the recognition that she maybe deserved as far as her part with just the world that she lived in and the community in England, particularly during the bombing and so forth. Mm. But that was kind of typical at the time. And how she would go off and do all of this charity work all day long, really important stuff. For the war effort, but always made sure she was back at home that night, beautifully dressed, ready with a lovely dinner.
Yes, I mean, she believed very much in during war, there was no excuse to look scruffy or anything but glamorous and well turned out. You know, sometimes in Downing Street, they didn't even have hot water because bombs would be falling all around, the gas would go, you know, there was no way of heating up water. And so she would use benzene, which is a sort of rather actually dangerous chemical, and wash her hair in that because that gave it shine. And she really always tried to look immaculate and beautifully dressed, and she believed as good food as possible, which was difficult because we had very, very severe rationing in Britain. But she believed good meals, elegant dress, you should dress for dinner. These things were so important for morale, and particularly Churchill's morale. He loved food. It made him happy. So she went to incredible lengths to make sure that even with the very, very scarce supplies she had, that he would always have a good table, a good dinner, a good lunch, a good breakfast. She also knew that he really wanted her to be around at those meals. He wanted to discuss things with her. So although she would be doing a lot of her own work during the day, she had what she called her espionage network. She got his staff to tell her when meetings were going to finish, when he was going to be likely to be free for lunch, so that she could somehow miraculously appear. And he would think perhaps that she'd been there all morning. She hadn't. She may have been in five different air raid shelters trying to get things improved. She may have been having very, very high-level meetings with people. But he would arrive for lunch. She would look beautiful. The meal would be beautiful. In the evening, candles would be lit. This was war. But she created this kind of magic, this aura, this feeling of well-being. You know, and he was in his mid to late 60s. He had the burden of the world on him. He smoked, he drank, he took no exercise. He had to find, you know, sustenance from somewhere, and that was the home life that she gave him, quite apart from all the political support she gave him too.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. My guest is Sonia Purnell, journalist and author of the new book entitled Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Was it her liberalism that drove her to do a lot of that work during the war, the charities, the various drives, lobbying on behalf of ordinary people? She wore her hair. She wore the turbans that the factory worker women wore to keep their hair safe from the machines. She kind of went the whole 10 yards.
She did, and you're quite right to sort of draw attention to those turbans. If you look at the wartime photos of her, she used to wear these turbans, quite often of beautiful material, sometimes with fabrics printed with the words from his speeches. She didn't do this because she thought she looked particularly beautiful, and she did it because, as you say, this is her tribute. This is her sort of symbol of solidarity with all those millions of women who were working in factories for the war effort, producing, you know, munitions and aeroplanes and all the rest of it. She understood that for quite a lot of the war, all Britain had going for it was the sense of being in it together. There couldn't be a difference in the way that classes behaved or were treated. There had to be that feeling of unity. She saw that very clearly, and yes, I do think that she got that partly from her liberalism, but also partly from the mistakes made by the prime ministers during the First World War, mm-hmm. Asquith in particular. She saw that you really, really all had to be pulling in the same direction and feeling complete solidarity with everyone. And you know, one of the things that she came up with right at the beginning of the war, in tandem with Winston, but very much from her point of view, was that she realised that he really needed to use words in those speeches. If they were to be galvanising and inspiring, they had to use words that anyone with only a very basic education would understand, and they wouldn't need to look up in a dictionary. It would be sort of simple words. And if you think about those speeches, the words are simple, and the power of them is all the sort of the bigger and the more remarkable because of that. And again, that was something that she felt very, very strongly about, and again just shows how closely involved she was with everything. But it really was something that Britain had to everyone had to draw together. And it's interesting, many Americans who came over during the war remarked on how incredible that Blitz spirit, that feeling of solidarity, that feeling of we can take it together was. And that she worked very, very hard on that. And she also, I say, drew inspiration from Eleanor Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt came over in 1942 on a tour, and she saw how chatty and informal and friendly Eleanor Roosevelt was with crowds of people, how keen she was to talk to people. And Clementine was very much inspired by her. And it's interesting that Henry Morgenthau, who was FDR's Treasury Secretary, came over to Britain towards the end of the war, and he saw Clementine in action with the crowds, saw how friendly and how practical she was, and wrote in his diary, "The dame is unbelievable. She's just like Mrs. Roosevelt." No. And I think, you know, it's interesting how Clementine and Eleanor learned from each other, but certainly they both realised that sort of informality, that chattiness, that approachability was really important.
She was like the perfect cross between, say, a Jackie Onassis with her style sense and an Eleanor Roosevelt for her connection with the ordinary people.
Absolutely. Bang on. That's absolutely right. She was a style setter. The way that she dressed, her coats, became known as the Clementines because they had a little button at the top. They were often in sort of leopard skin materials and things, quite dramatic. She stood out in the crowd. People loved them and tried to copy them as much as she could. Her decor, I've already mentioned how she could create a magical sort of interior, even from the sort of worn, torn offices that the church was lived in during the war. Somehow, with some paintings, antiques, flowers, photographs, she made them look beautiful and elegant. She just had that great eye. And just like Jackie O, people really wanted to copy her, to see what she was doing next, to look at her. And she became a style icon. But, as you say, with the friendliness, with the approachability of Eleanor Roosevelt, I think she had the best of both of those women in a way.
And what she didn't have, what she lacked, that neither of them really lacked, was money. I mean, they were strapped all the time. I was shocked that I didn't really know that Winston Churchill was a gambler and that he just didn't know how to hang on to a buck. He was, you know, the incredible home they bought, which she hated, he did so behind her back.
Yes, he did. I mean, she said
that's
that was
shocking.
The one and only time he betrayed her. Yeah. He wasn't, you know, he didn't betray her with other women, but he did betray her by buying Chartwell when she knew they couldn't afford it. They had 20 full-time staff there, again, like Downton Abbey, unbelievably expensive. But, you know, they just didn't have the resources. They didn't have the income to pay for that. She knew that was the case. And sure enough, you know, 2, 3, 4 times, they were on the verge of bankruptcy. She was constantly worried about money. We heard that clip earlier about not paying the butcher.
Yeah.
All the tradesmen used to, you know, queue up outside demanding money. It was humiliating for her. She remembered what it was like in her childhood. Churchill, very different, extravagant, always thought that something would come along, something would sort it out. And do you know what? Something always did come along. Usually some businessman would come along and bail them out. I don't think it would be allowed now, but then it was. And and somehow they were saved on each occasion by the generosity of others. Extraordinary.
Well, he complained that he had to work so hard to keep them, you know, keep to support the family, and she would respond, well, you wouldn't have to work so hard if you didn't spend so much.
Absolutely. I mean, that money came from his pen, which, you know, he had to keep writing books, keep writing articles, because, you know, otherwise the lights would literally go off and the servants would have to be let go and all the rest of it. He was constantly working. He worked incredibly hard, but she was quite right. He wouldn't have had to work quite so hard if the champagne hadn't always been Paul Roger, if he hadn't had to have a valet always and a butler and under butlers and chambermaids and 19 bedrooms and, you know, however many bathrooms it was. You know, he wanted to live like a duke, but he didn't have a duke's income. This was a problem for their entire lives.
We are talking about the life and times of Clementine Churchill, wife of Sir Winston Churchill for 57 years. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We will return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the life and times of Clementine Churchill, wife of the British Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill. The HBO film, The Gathering Storm, is based on their lives together and apart as England wrestles with the issue of the Nazi buildup. In this scene, they are dining when Clementine mentions that she has been invited on a cruise that is to span several months. Winston is immediately perturbed.
Well, don't you think it just might be construed as just a little selfish? Well, don't you? Huh?
Winston, do not accuse me of being selfish. Do not dare! I've spent the last 26 years of my life trying to please you, and I've done everything, and I mean everything. I put your happiness before the children's happiness, before my happiness. You're the most self-centered man I've ever met.
This conversation brought out two issues, his dependence on her and her independence of him and her way with anger. So with us is journalist and author of a new biography of Clementine Churchill entitled Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill, Sonia Purnell. Thanks again, Sonia, for joining us.
Great pleasure.
I love that scene. she often traveled to ease her nerves, and a lot of people would not think Winston was out of line for suggesting that a four-month voyage might be a bit much for a woman with so many children at home, but she was pretty adamant about taking her breaks.
Yes, she was. She knew that her only sort of means of survival was to have a break sometimes from Churchill. Being married to him was like being married to a hurricane. I mean, nothing ever stayed still. It was complete chaos and pandemonium and excitement and movement and noise the whole time. Her nerves simply couldn't take it sometimes. And that clip is quite right. She did completely devote her life to him, his needs, his career. And he was very difficult. He was particularly difficult, actually, it must be said, when he was out of power. Power pleased him. When he was out of power, as he was during that clip in the 1930s, he was very bad-tempered, very irascible. He was very selfish, and he wasn't an egotist. And sometimes she needed to get away. And actually, she did also have a temper. Both of them had tempers. And her staff, you know, some of them are still alive, and I tracked them down. I got wonderful accounts of them. And her eyes would flash with fury sometimes. And they'd hear raised voices behind the door, and then Churchill would come out and say, I'm afraid Mrs. C is very angry with me today. And they'd all feel terribly sorry for him. But he was a difficult man to be with full time. So, yeah, sometimes she would take vacations away. And the vacation that she's talking about there, the cruise, was in the South Seas. They were looking for a Komodo dragon for London Zoo. And there was on board this beautiful yacht where she was staying, this very, very handsome, attentive, younger, rich, urbane, athletic, tanned,
interesting man, and she did sort of fall in love. I mean, she was nearly 50, but there was this very, very exciting man who paid her attention. I mean, the church would sometimes forget that she existed. He certainly wasn't the sort of husband who would say, "You look beautiful in that dress tonight, darling." And here was a man who was paying her a lot of attention. And this shook Clementine to the core. She wasn't sure what to do. He wasn't in love with her. And in the end, it came to nothing. And I think that sort of that moment on that cruise made her realize when she came back just what an extraordinary marriage she had. However turbulent, however tough it was, however problematic it was, she realized that she had the most extraordinary husband, certainly not the easiest husband, but that she was very much part of his team, the other part of the other half of his team, and she really wanted him to become Prime Minister, and she really helped him alert Britain and the world to the dangers of, you know, Hitler and Nazi Germany, and she saw that her life's work was helping him and making him a great man. So there was that wobble in the mid-1930s, but I think it made her see more clearly in the long run. I think also it made Winston realize just how important she was.
Iris in Columbus, you're on the air with Sonia Purnell, author of Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I had a couple of quick questions and comments. My mother had a book called Winston and Clementine, The Personal Letters of the Churchills, and I wondered if the author was familiar with that, if she had possibly used it in her research. And then also, she had described Clementine as kind of Winston's conscience, and Eleanor Roosevelt was kind of described that way with Franklin Roosevelt, too, so I wondered if that was a similarity. And what did Clementine think of the friendship of Winston and FDR?
Okay, well, let's start with the book, first of all, and the letters between them. They're extracts, and that's sort of an edited collection, so I went to the originals over here in Britain at Cambridge, at Churchill College up in Cambridge. There are hundreds and hundreds of letters, wonderful, all in the original there. You can see her wonderful curly handwriting. Interesting, you can also tell when she's cross or angry because her handwriting goes a little awry and isn't quite so beautifully curly, but much, much better to look at the originals, and a lot of things left out in that collection which were really thrilling, and also letters to other people, other artifacts, tapes, recordings, interviews and things. Superb, many of them simply not looked at before. So, yes, and on to the conscience, you know, I'm talking about Clementine being Churchill's conscience, and I'm very aware that there were many, many parallels between Clementine and Eleanor. And I think the two women were very aware of that too. And they formed this bond of mutual respect and admiration and trust. And over time, that became affection too. And they became friends. And they stayed very much in touch after the war as well. And they played a similar role with their husbands, this conscience thing. But I would say that during the war, Clementine, who was involved in everything, every aspect of the war, was probably more powerful and more influential than Eleanor, who FDR shut out to some extent. Mm-hmm. Once the war started, she was no longer as important to him. And there was this remarkable incident one evening in the White House when Churchill and FDR were having drinks, and Churchill said to FDR he was surprised that Eleanor wasn't included in all aspects of the war, and he said, "I tell Clemmy everything." And FDR said, "Yes, I've noticed that, but I can't tell Eleanor everything because I don't know that she might not put it in her newspaper column tomorrow by mistake." So he slightly distanced Eleanor at that point, but Clementine was involved in everything. She knew all about the Bletchley Park secrets, for instance. So that was the difference between them.
Well, Eleanor had a much more public life, and in a way I kind of understood that explanation as, you know, like she's too public.
Yes, I think that's right. And I suppose Clementine played a slightly more subtle role behind the scenes a lot of the time, although she became more and more of a public figure towards the end of the war. Again, actually, I think inspired by Eleanor. But she never contradicted her husband in public or came up with different ideas. It was very much that they were part of the same team. And they were closer, I think, than the Roosevelts were by this point. I mean, there'd been no catastrophe in their marriage, like FDR's affair, you know, the effect that that had had on the Roosevelts' marriage. And so the churches were still very close, very much bound up in the same thing. And there had been that distancing in the Roosevelts' relationship, which was quite different.
Iris, thanks so much for your call. Jim in Cleveland, you're on the air. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hi, Anne. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. Very interesting show. I've always been fascinated by Winston Churchill, knew very little about Clementine, except for the war photos, of course, with her. Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. What an interesting show. I've always been very fascinated, of course, with Winston Churchill and of course, the war years, and knew very little about Clementine's role, except for the old war photos. Obviously, you mentioned the turbans and how she was always by his side. The parallels to Eleanor Roosevelt. I know that Eleanor had a troubled childhood, very volatile and insecure, and obviously Clementine did also. Eleanor developed an inner circle of friends, somewhat separate from Franklin, and I was just wondering if Clementine might have had some inner circle or a separate life that sustained her apart from her marriage to Winston.
Well, that's such a great question, and the short answer to it is no. During the Second World War, the few friends that she did have, she couldn't see. She knew, as I say, everything, every cabinet secret decrypt, every military secret. She simply felt she couldn't see people outside that sort of small entourage that they had. And so she was effectively cut off. And also simply that, you know, Churchill was so demanding that she rarely had time to make her own friends or see old ones. Before the war, she saw her cousin Sylvia Henley a little bit, but then Sylvia Henley's son-in-law was seen as a security risk during the war, and even though her daughter had divorced him, Clementine felt that she could no longer see Sylvia Henley during the war and had to push her away, and this was very painful for her. So she had no outside interest apart from Churchill. She didn't really have a circle of friends, and it wasn't until he died in 1965 that she could revive old friendships and make new ones. And she had 12, 13 years after his death when her life was totally different. And, you know, in some ways a more balanced life because she did have friendships and a social life. But during her marriage, she really had very few opportunities to do that. So in that way, she was very different from Eleanor.
Thanks, Jim, for that call. Appreciate it. You know, it's funny, going back to what Iris brought up about the correspondence between them, you noted in your book that the frequent separations really created a treasure trove of correspondence between them that they might not have had if they had been together all during all those times.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, thank
Yeah, I know. Thank God they were separate.
I know, because we would be so much the poorer without those letters, which tell us so much. And I think biographers in the future are going to find life very difficult because they're not going to have, people just don't write letters like that. And the other thing is that the Churchills wrote to each other even when they were under the same roof. You know, they'd send a little note down the corridor, a servant would take a note down the corridor. So even when they were in the same building, in the same city, in the same country, they still wrote to each other. So we still have this absolute wealth of material to look at. But as I say, you know, there are still people alive who remember serving them. I tracked down five or six of her PAs who were still alive. Two or three of them probably never spoken to anyone before. When you worked for Churchill, you were totally included in the family and what they were doing. You were part of everything. So they give us a really clear, illuminating, affectionate insight as to what life was like with the Churchills.
I wanted to go back to something that I thought was so critical, just, I guess, from being in a journalist myself for 30-odd years, was her savvy when it came to the press and Winston's exposure to it and how she managed it. She cultivated relationships in among journalists as well.
She did, you know, right from the First World War when he was away fighting at the front.
and, you know, the Western Front, and in Northern France, he was in the trenches for about 5 months. And this was after the Dardanelles, Gallipoli, when his, after that military disaster, his career had come to a full stop. It looked like it was completely over. He went off very much with her encouragement to fight at the front, to try and acquire what she called his military halo, basically redemption. This is the only way he could retrieve himself, redeem himself. While he was away, she became this really extraordinary lobbyist and spin doctor and press secretary. She courted journalists, ones that she thought that might be friendly and might write pieces about how he was volunteering to fight and how brave and selfless that was. She didn't stop there. She invited newspaper proprietors, newspaper editors to lunch. She invited the prime minister to dinner. She invited other ministers and military chiefs to dinner and lunch. This is all at a time when she was, you know, not much more than 30 and couldn't vote. Women couldn't vote in Britain at that point. And so she just became someone who seems to have almost had a sort of intuitive feel for these things and how to present a case and how to keep, as she put it, the journalists at arm's length, but at the same time get across the point of view. And she was very excited as the sort of the press changed their minds about Churchill during the First World War. And that was to happen again and again in his political life. You know, he was often out of favour, but slowly, slowly he would sort of work his way back into favour, back into glory with her help. And she was very clever. She understood the media much better than he did.
Mm-hmm.
She understood the need for a public image. And I'll give you just one example for that. As I was saying before, all Britain had going for it was that everyone was in it together. And she understood the importance of that. And she heard about a great niece being evacuated to America to escape the bombing raids. But the great niece had the Churchill surname. She knew that no Churchill could be seen to be leaving the country to be evacuated. It simply wasn't possible, wasn't plausible, wasn't thinkable.
Mm-hmm.
And so she withdrew this child's passport and had officials stop boarding the liner to come to America. You might say that was harsh. In a way, it was. But at the same time, she realised that that was absolutely essential. The Churchills couldn't be preaching one thing to others and allowing their family to do something else. So she understood that that public image idea was absolutely crucial and was always looking out for Winston and how he could keep his public image as good as possible.
And at the same time, really keeping up people's spirits.
Yeah, that the spirits thing was very important. They used to go to a lot of bomb sites together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would travel all over the country to where the worst bombing raids had been. And one occasion he picked up an honorary degree in Bristol, and the morning after a terrible, terrible raid, and no one had slept the previous night. People had clothes over their pajamas. They hadn't been able to go home and, you know, get their sort of new clothes. I mean, it was extraordinary, but you always had to look like this was just normal and that you never entertained the idea that victory wasn't certain. And she smiled and she talked to people and she made sure they had somewhere to sleep that night and that they'd had food and that their children were okay. She was very good at the practical aspect because she knew that morale was absolutely essential and that these little things, or not very little things, everyone had to be treated mm-hmm. well and that everything had to be planned and that so much help had to be given to them. And she understood that. And she became incredibly popular as a result. Actually, towards the end of the war, her polling showed that she was more popular than Churchill, and that lasted for quite a long time.
Sonia Purnell, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's been a great pleasure.
Sonia Purnell, she's a journalist and author of a new book entitled Clementine, The Life of Mrs. Winston Churchill. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsminsky and Amber Karsminsky. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.